Today's guest is Matt Purcell, who was born in a small town in South Korea to a young mother who was unable to raise him. This sparked an incredible work ethic in Matt, who gained qualifications in mental health and founded the Green Room MP, helping hundreds of people with music and life coaching. Matt later founded Caillou Media, an award-winning creative agency. As a leader in personal branding, he's worked with ABC, Westfield, Sony, Amex, and much more. He's also the founder of Social Kung Fu, Australia's number one verbal self-defense and confidence training for students. His mission is to impact 1 million young people with his training against bullying and dehumanization and raise a generation to become more self-aware. His passion and work ethic are embedded within everything he does, and I'm very grateful and excited to have him on the show today. I was really impressed with Matt's ability to talk about characters and brands and then link that back to the character and brand story that we're telling inside our own minds, because often we are just the sum of the stories that we play out in our mind. And so there's some really useful tips and tools on how to restructure your own narrative and find a lot of inspiration and resilience from how Matt has been able to build an incredibly inspiring life despite his circumstances. So without further ado, here is Matt. So Matt, we're in very similar spaces and you have a passion for helping people, particularly young people. And I think most people who end up in our space do so because of lived experience. Can you tell me about a time, your earliest memory, where you thought to yourself, I am not enough?
I remember being in year, I remember when I was 7 years old, I went to a new school and my parents just separated only 2 weeks before. And I was one of only three Asian kids in the school. And I got on the new school bus and year seven students would just use me as a human boxing bag and my backpack would become a soccer ball. And I couldn't shake them. I couldn't distract them, couldn't defend myself. And then a few weeks later, they took it too far and threw me in a whiz bin. And they did that for days. And I kept it secret from my mum, who was working a couple jobs, and washed my clothes to try and keep it secret. And then she eventually found out. And that was the very first time I felt literally like a piece of rubbish, literally like, couldn't defend myself. My voice wasn't heard. And after the event, the bullying stopped because the principal and all that got involved, but the words started and they were like verbal punches. And I remember just getting abused verbally for months, and my friends would be there, but they wouldn't say anything. No one would defend me. And all I knew was to do was to hit back with, I'd Will Smith people back and hit them when they would say things to me. So that was the only thing I knew within me to do. So that was the first memory of feeling worthless.
Yeah, I'll bet, man. That is absolutely deplorable that that happens. And do you think that that still happens? I know that might seem like a very naive question, but I like to believe that things are getting better based on your work with students. Is that level of bullying still occurring?
Yeah, it is. I travel to regional areas as well as cities, and it's a lot of physical bullying still happens. Like I was in Swan Hill, which is like on the border of New South Wales and Victoria. It has the highest rate of teenage pregnancy in the state. It's only a small town. And an incident happened recently in the school where a massive fight broke out. And yeah, schools are really struggling to be able to know what to do and how to manage it. But a lot of it came from cyber. A lot of it was building up over months, and a lot of tension with words and typing and talking were the big triggers that led to a big fight. So it does happen. I think a lot of it these days is verbal and texting and cyber. which is, I mean, if you think about cyber, it's that's only what fairly new in a history of being followed home and not being able to escape the day, check out from the bully. So it still happens, but takes many forms.
Do you think that the experience still lives with you today and shapes the way that you view the world? Because you've obviously done a lot of work on yourself to be a very confident man who stands on stage and is sure of himself. Is that voice of the bully still tucked away somewhere in your brain?
No, I don't think the voices are there. They're not, at least they're not very loud. If they were there, they've been completely, I guess, drowned out with residents in my mind that I've approved of to be in it. So I have had to learn that my life is like a living house, and inside my house are valuable things like my dreams and my health and my relationships. And a lot of people treat their lives like a lot of people treat their own physical house better than their own mental health, where a stranger could knock on their door and be like, "Hey, can you let me in?" And most people would be like, "No, who are you?" And they have more of a boundary and value on their physical house than strangers that come up to you and say, "You're a piece of crap." And some and that's something I've really, like you said, I've really had to work on, but I think it's definitely a villain in my story that drives me forward toward a goal rather than pulls me down. I that if that voice exists, it's the justice in me that goes, I don't want anyone to feel helpless and worthless like that without you can do something about it now. You can say something back.
Why do some people recover from experiences like that and turn out to be people like you versus people who don't and carry a traumatized, just distorted view of the world for a very long time because of what was done to them in childhood?
Yeah, I mean, as an adoptee, even like I've met a lot of adoptees, and it's been 50-50 where they've seen their life as half empty or half full, and half empty or yeah, the other way, yeah. And I think it comes down to, I mean, it's cliche, but as cliche as it is, it's like the reinforcement of people in your life and the external. Like for me, what's really helped me is to be able to distinguish the difference between relying on external validation or internal referencing. Meaning, if I depend on solely on the feedback and solely on the external praises or criticisms from people externally, then I'm forever insecure and forever needing that to feed me and to keep me secure. That's the only source of food I have for my identity. And I think it's when you can find either a person in your life or an event in your life which makes you look to go, okay, I can't rely on just external people to tell me who I am. I need to internally do work, internally reference, like what triggers me? What are my dreams? Is it really true what they're saying? This stress mine or someone else's? That's all internal referencing versus how do they think of me? What's going to make them happy? What can I do to prove myself? That's all external. So I think for my life, it came down to some people, which I'm so glad for my mother that she put me into a local youth group when I was a teenager who were relevant and cool and hip, but also talked about meaning and deeper issues and lived out a different culture that really influenced me to think about those things.
That's a very good way of explaining the power of connection and how, when we are nurtured in the right way, it can overcome even the hardest of traumas. And there's a bunch of research on how attachment style can guard against symptomology later down the track as an adult if you have the right people around you to help process and work through it. When people choose the glass half empty option, do you think that's because they don't have that type of support around them? Or do you think some people are born more, maybe, I don't know if optimistic and resilient is the word, but why do you think that occurs?
Yeah, I think I've met people that have, we've all met people, say, for example, externally, culturally, they're beautiful. They're physically beautiful. They're talented. They've got something good going for them. Yet they feel like they're never enough. You know, I had a very pretty friend in high school, and she forever never believed anything we told her that, you know, you're beautiful inside out. She said, no, I'm not. And her family were loving, and she scored well. I said all the evidence was there externally, but she was the only one who never believed it. And from the outside looking in, you could say that, some people would naively say, oh, she's just seeking attention, or she was just. But sometimes there are hardware and software issues. Like, what I mean by that is externally, an external thing is you might see someone with a broken ligament, and that's totally understandable that you shouldn't expect them to lift anything with that arm, or a visible disability. But when it comes to internal invisible issues, such as insecurity, or maybe the tendency to be more depressed, or to be more, you'd have the research on that, Mitch. I think that's less, we don't have the tools to be able to know how to, generally speaking, how do we approach someone with that, with empathy and with that's useful. Instead of saying, you're wrong, you're beautiful, you're wrong, that you've got, see all the external things. Why do you disagree with me, instead of having this argumentative chat? So I'd throw that back to you, Mitch. Like, what do you think about, from your research that you found, do people tend to lean toward that side of being more, the glass is half empty genetically, or is it, When externally things are okay, like in this case with my friend?
Yeah, I think it can be a mixture of both nature and nurture. But what I also believe is true is that the way you view yourself is more of a choice than you believe. And the story that gets created is more important than the situations that you endure. And a story is malleable, it's plastic, it's adaptable. And it's choosable. And so I know that you're an expert in personal branding and helping people establish themselves as a being known for something and standing for something. How do you think personal brand from a mental health perspective plays out when you have a negative self story and you so badly want the world to view you as something else? How do you cross the bridge?
Yeah. There's an old Testament in the Bible. There's this old Ten Commandments, and one of them is you shall not bear false witness to your neighbor. And one day when I just came across that years ago, it's always stuck to me with personal branding in a weird way, because like bear witness to your neighbor, bearing witness is a legal term, and basically when you're at court and you put on the stand, you just have to give an account of what you've seen, what you've heard, and what you felt. Like you've got to give account to what's been in your life as facts. And how I help people start the journey with, if they've got a negative view of themselves, is like, you need to look at bearing witness to what you've done. But so many people are more competent than what they think, and the evidence is there. And I need to point them in that right direction and say, like, listen, let's look at your timeline. You have grown a great business. You have a great family. You're profiting here. You've won an award here. Or you even for your family history, you've come from this and not repeated the cycle. And that's part of your journey. And we're crafting some of this. That there's some of the ingredients we have then to be able to craft it's self-creation. This concept of self-creation, we can craft a new story you can believe in based on not imaginary things, but on facts. And that's where I begin when people who are insecure about themselves.
Yeah, it's a cognitive behavioral therapy technique, right? Is to challenge false stories with actual evidence and facts. And it's hard to see evidence when your story feels so familiar that it feels like a fact. And it is through deep investigation and challenging that we are able to craft a new view of ourselves and the world. As a personal brand expert, what's the one word that you want to be, you want people to describe you as?
One word. Oh, I guess one word would be honest. Yeah, honest. I think personal branding is a lot to do with identity. That's why I love the work. That's why it makes so much sense with my journey from being an adoptee to have gone through what I've gone through and wanting to help people with their identities, through youth to professionals. When you know who you are, you become less shakable and you have then a base to build on. You're not changing costumes every second because you're told, like, it's true security when you know who you are. If you don't know who you are, then you're at the, you risk, I don't know, just building seven things and you're not sure what you're doing it for. You're not knowing who you're doing it for. So yeah, I think it's personal branding is a synonym for identity building for me.
Yeah. And what are some of the most stable building blocks you have found for someone to achieve a positive personal brand on social media? And I'm curious to see what the answers are, because it might correlate to how people use those building blocks to build their own mental health.
Yeah, I'll give a little bit of a framework with story building for personal branding. And I'm going to borrow a page from our good friend Peter Parker. I love Peter Parker. As a kid, I loved Spider-Man. And some of the best personal brands are actually not real people. They're like forever, they're the most promotable brands are like the Tony Starks who Audi paid $300 million to put him in. He's not a real person. Or James Bond, who Omega pays millions of dollars to, and he's not a real person. And the thing that really sticks out about Spider-Man's story for me, and you can use this framework for your own brands, is Peter has a context. Where's he from? He's from Manhattan. Lives with his Aunt May, Uncle Ben, and his parents passed away. What's his situation at school? Well, he's a nerdy kid. He's not cool. He's awkward around girls. He's a nerd, essentially, in the comics. And then you go into, there was a defining moment. Something happened in his life where he was bitten by a spider, and that gave him an ability. He discovered an ability, climbing walls, super strength, all these things. But he's not yet a hero or a villain yet. He discovered his purpose through tragedy, through pain, which is when he let a criminal go, and that criminal actually ended up killing his uncle. And his uncle, on his dying words, were, you know, remember what I said, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. And that was when Spider-Man was birthed. So it was from context to discovery of abilities to then discovering purpose. And then that's at one end of the spectrum. And the other end of the spectrum, there's the defining attributes of Spider-Man. The alter ego of Spider-Man, which is Peter, and then the ego, the other side of it, is Spider-Man, which is, what's his defining physical attributes? Well, you see the colors red and blue. You see a spider symbol. That's your logo. You see certain powers that he has. That's what Spider-Man's known for. And if you have a spectrum like this, when you get closer in the middle from your story and your hero with the mask, you become more authentic. And I think that's where the sweet spot is.
So we're trying to close the gap between what people think we are and who we are. And it's authenticity that really allows people to shine bright.
That's right. Yeah. And I'll say this too, like, some would say, hey, Matt, is that a little bit like, are you saying to curate some things? And I'm suggesting, yeah, you do. And curation's become a dirty C word to some content creators or people who are on the full authentic route. And I think when you go for a job interview, you don't say, I like sushi in your resume. You don't say, I like Bonds as my underwear. You curate. You want to present in context the best message forward for yourself to be able to get the role that suits their organization. Resumes are a marketing document. People might think, I'm not a marketer, but resumes are for the person who are looking to hire, not about you, it's for them. So it's the same type of deal. How can I craft my story with the important parts? That's what movies are so good at. You never see Jason Bourne in a movie with a scene where he goes up to Fitness First and gets his membership sign up and goes through the list with the receptionist. That's not in any movie, because what's the point? So the story has to, everything has to support the story. Every note, every lyric, no matter how skilled you are, no matter how technically good you are in a song, everything has to be rendered under it. Does it support the song or does it distract from the song? And it's the same as the message.
Yeah, perception really is just the sum of a bunch of small, discrete parts that end up adding up to become who we are. And then that image of the way that we are viewed by the world gets perpetually reinforced back to us and creates a character. I think some people feel trapped by the character that the world views them as, and then they've reinforced themselves to be. Have you had instances where you've worked with people who don't want to be perceived a certain way and actually want to change that? And if so, do they have to change internally before the external world sees it as that?
That's a good question. I think I'll give you an example. We call it a rebrand in personal branding. So you're known maybe as one thing, but you want to start repositioning yourself into a new channel or a new, to be known as a new thing. It's two different topics to say that if you're known for a bad thing, you've got to pass and you're going to make it good, better, because you've got all these sins there, and especially if they're made public, that's like a big PR piece. That's a lot of time. It's not impossible, but you can do it. But say you, Lane Beachley's a good friend of mine, I love Lane Beachley more than most people in the world. She's a sister. She's adopted as well, like me. She went through a whole period where she was in an industry where the men were getting $1 million prize money and the women were getting 90 grand as world champions. And she was one of the most strongest voices to help surfing become the first sport in history to be equally paid with women and men. So surfing was the very first sport in history where the prize money was the same. And Lane was really behind that in the board meetings, in corporate spaces. And when she finished as a 7-time world champion, she was scratching her head going, I'm an ex-athlete now. What do I do? I've got so much to give. I'm known as forever frozen in time as a surfer, but I want to help people because of all the resilience she had built being in that industry, building a great brand where she lived off her. She's a great brand in her own right with endorsements. She's left millions of dollars on the table because it didn't suit her brand. She'd tell you, Bundaberg Rum offering $1 million for Lane Beachley to be an ambassador doesn't suit the brand. She's left $1 million on the table. That's an example of how power, if you know who you are, you're going to have to say no to big paying things like that sometimes, because that's like selling out is literally that definition. I know who I am, but I'm willing to trade out who I am for a dollar, a buck. That's just like divorcing this relationship you have with yourself, this certainty you have yourself. So back to my point, like Lane was honestly 7 times world champion, but she wanted to be able to position herself more in the wellness space, in being a champion for wellness. So the exercise we had to do then, she went on a lot of inner work. She went on a journey where she actually got trained in mental health. She's a mental health aid, first aid. She's gone to she's gone through a lot of training over the last 10 years to be able to verse herself with the right way to be able to explain to her audience what she went through and some tools. So there was inner work done before she went public with it. And I think that's really important, because if you don't do the inner work first before you rebrand, then you're like a guitarist who's just saying, I'm a professional guitarist, but I'm learning every week to stay afloat. You've got to do the work beforehand. So that's why I respect brands who stand the test of time, because behind every good brand, behind any good personal brand, has been about 6 to 12 months sometimes of re-educating themselves and versing themselves on their new area.
So the work does happen internally in order to be externally achieved. What's curious about Lane's story, who by all accounts seems to be an amazing person and has achieved so much, is that she, by rejecting deals like with Bundaberg, to draw a parallel to mental health, I think it's like rejecting people and things that don't align to the values of who you are and who you want to be. Because there are multiple moments on our journey when we're experiencing anxiety and depression that there are quick wins that come up that look to be appealing. For example, you might turn to alcohol or drugs, or you might go towards people who give you false validation that's not actually true. And the result of that is that the perception of ourself being not aligned with who we want to be gets reinforced, and we're further away from our true essence. And I think what Lane did from a more of an external marketing perspective has a lot of similarities to what we need to do internally, which is know who we are so much so, or know who we want to be so much so, that we get very good at saying no to things that don't fall in line with that as much as we get good at saying yes. Because at the end of the day, the character that we're all striving to be is playing out now. The quality of our mental health is determining our mental health at all points in time. Like if you have a negative view of self and you do things every day in your life that reinforces that you're not who you want to be, that is a path to rock bottom. But if you're constantly having the disciplined pursuit of reinforcing the aspirational character that you want to become, you will become that character. The difference is those who are disciplined enough to stay on the path.
That's so true. And you see that in relationships a lot socially, where one of the saddest stories I've heard in my life was for my mum. And it was from my mum, and she had just a close friend split up with her partner, and she was with a new guy very quickly. And my mum wasn't being judgmental or anything, but she asked her, like, wow, what happened? So, like, you've moved on pretty quick. Like, you must be the one. Like, what is it? And she's like, it's the best I could do. And it's like, wow, like, that's just an example to your point of, I think, when you struggle to, you have your negative review of yourself, you'll take what you feel like, what you think you're, here's the thing, here's in one phrase, it's how you think of yourself determines what you think you deserve. So if I don't think I'm much, then from my mum's friend's point of view, this is the best I could do. That's how it acts itself out.
Yeah, I do believe that we attract into our life what we think we deserve and are worthy of. And the hardest part is shifting our internal sense of worth. A huge thing. Other than surrounding yourself with the right people, can you give me two, maybe three examples of how you've built self-worth over the course of your life after being told, to use your words, you were a piece of garbage?
When I was 12, my dad gave me a guitar, and I had no idea if I'd take to it or not, being that young. But I discovered very quickly that this instrument or music and me was like the perfect match made in heaven, creativity to express myself through something other than anger or through physical lashing out or verbally losing control. So I had an outlet that re-channeled my energy towards something beautiful. And I remember when I was about 14, 15, I started getting really, really good at it because I was intrinsically motivated to learn. And I was quickly recognized by a lot of people in my school and in the city. I was playing gigs by, I was 15, 16. I played session music, played a tour with Jimmy Barnes when I was in my early 20s. I was, you know, session music. And I remember I was 14 years old and I was figuring out by ear one of the hardest songs I'd had in my mind. If I could learn this song, I'm doing all right. And I was, as I was figuring out in real time, no guitar teacher, just ringing by ear, I caught myself looking at myself going, you know what, Matt, you're not a piece of shit. Mm. And that was one of the best therapies I've ever had in my life, was being able to get on a guitar or get something creative, have an aim, and being able to have this gift to be able to figure out patterns. Pattern recognition is one of the strongest things in my arsenal. I can look at a movie, can hear a song, I know what key it's in, I know how to replicate that, I know the gradients to be able to, and then make it contextual to a person. And that was one of the best building blocks for my confidence, because one, that was an ability, like something I could actually pave, you know, be productive with. It can earn a living, it can help people. The second thing was having a verbal sparring partner. Verbal sparring partners are just like having a boxing partner. You're not trying to kill each other in the ring, but you do have simulations of real debate, testing out ideas, testing out moves, not having a safe space to be able to say, I had this thought about some controversial idea without the fear of being judged for it or being posted on about, and help someone going, what's the best argument against that, Matt? Like, oh, I didn't think about that. And then getting better and better and better. So that was intellectually brawling in a way through conversation, sparring. And the third thing, I guess, if it was the third thing for me, was having a philosophy. Philosophy is the great middle ground, or it can be the primary main show for a lot of people, that helps you make sense of things in life. There's science, which is amazing. Science is incredible with the study of observations of behavior in the world. And philosophy is, philo means in the Greek, means lover of wisdom. Philo, lover, sophie of wisdom. And when I discover philosophy like Socrates and Plato and Seneca and all these things as an early 20-year-old, it changed my life, because it gave my brain an OS system to be able to put my problems through. And it helped me, gave me tools to, that combined with some science or some mental health training, was like, maybe just zoom out, pinch out rather than double tap. I can double tap on things and zoom out because I have these tools. So I have, a talent, or something I can say, this is tangible. I've built a sparring partner to intellectually brawl and an OS system to make sense of problems.
Mm. I think what the first point you made speaks to is having something that you can be proud of as well. Mm. And I think having something you can be proud of builds a reason to want to get up of a morning. You know, the guitar, it wasn't the guitar that helped you build your self-worth. It was what it represented, right? It was that I have something that brings me joy, allows me to feel socially included. I get a positive behavioral loop because it's reinforced by people saying that they like it. I get to help people. But above all that, I get to be proud that I'm offering something to someone. And that is, I believe, why many of us can build self-worth, when we invest in a skill or a thing that has bigger meaning and purpose than just ourselves. And not skill for the sake of competition or for the sake of needing to be anywhere, but just feeling skillful in and of itself, I think, is very therapeutic. And I'm glad that was your experience.
Yeah. As I mentioned before, like internal referencing or internal validation. And that was one of the very first moments where I had decided that I like me doing this. This makes me feel good. And I can, the sky's the limit with this. This is like for me only. It was an audience of it. It was only honestly for an audience of one before it became for an audience of anyone else.
And when you say verbal sparring partner, is that just people in your life who you can be real with and feel heard from?
No, I think it's more intentional than that. It's actually, well, it's not an, it is like an agreement. Like not everyone of my friends are able to, they don't have the persona or the interest sometimes to be able to do this exercise. But I've got probably several, 5 to 7 people on my phone that we regularly in the car, they'll call me, I'll call them, or in nighttime. We'd be like, let's test you. What have you been thinking about lately? And we just hear it out, and and they expect a worthy opponent. It's not competition. It's actually out of curiosity. Am I on the right track? Have I thought this out much? In Japanese martial arts, there was a very valued principle on seeking to find a worthy opponent. So if you look at anime films like Naruto, One Punch Man, any fighting films, they're always, even Pokemon, they're always saying, so I need to fight someone who's better. And that's Japanese culture, because in order to be a master at something, you need to find someone who's worthy, who's equal or better than you to be able to, one, it shows you what your boundaries are, what your limits are. And two, that's the only way they believe to be able to get better. So I think in our Western culture, it's not a very comfortable feeling to naturally seek out someone to challenge you or to be challenged by. But when you find that, that's the principle I find. It's like, I want to find a worthy opponent. And I found people who want that too. And it's about the idea rather than the individual. We leave the conversation not with wiping blood from a mouth, but better and sharper. Iron sharpens
And so
iron.
how do you feel as though that helped you build your self-worth, that specific technique?
I think it was similar to the guitar in creativity. It's sometimes realizing that arriving at my own ideas. Okay, so for example, Mitch, in school, I got an asterisk for my HSE. So I got lower than 38 for my HSE. Look at me now, bitches. Anyway,
Totally.
and so for a long time, I thought I wasn't smart. And intellectually, having a sparring partner was really helpful for me to be able to internally accept myself that I am smart, because I naturally am a deep thinker from the things I went through as a kid. I was always gravitating toward things that were much more above what people talk about my age. And when I found someone who's willing to challenge and to listen and to grow and to be able to hear, that's actually right, you're on the right path. I'm talking to a psychologist, and they're like, yeah, that's right. Like you're saying with some things I'm saying, yes, it's cognitive bias, or that's cognitive behavior therapy. And it's like I'm arriving at these thoughts that I've been thinking are validated through research or from other people or challenged, and I have to rethink it, and I come back with a more better worldview. And that's helped me got smarter, become smarter in my own perspective, not just from other people's saying that I am. And yeah, similar discovery. I feel like it's the music. It's like I'm not a dumbass. My thoughts, a lot of my observations, and that builds trust in yourself. So that's when you can make more off the cuff decisions. Like, nah, that's a good move. Let's do that. Or you can have weight behind your words because they're well thought out, and you've done a lot of work in private to be able to arrive at that.
Yeah, totally agree. Self-trust is a massive component of being able to move through life a bit more freely, as opposed to just feeling like you're swimming through water to take another step forward. Whenever I have had some of my hardest moments in life, it's when I've trusted myself the least. It's a shit situation to be in. And I think when we can, in moments like that, when we can go back to anything that will help us remember that we have competence in something that starts to rebuild the self-trust. Because when it's gone, man, it's the worst place to be. You don't want to feel like you don't have your own back or you can't trust your own judgment.
Yeah, that's really true. Mitch, I'm curious to ask you a question with that. Like, what I talked a lot about, you know, like you articulated it so well about having something that you're proud of is good for confidence building. I talked about verbal sparring, so it's more of an intellectual competence. When you felt low in your life, what areas were knocked out? Like, did you feel like you were dumb? Did you feel like you were, were these confidence pillars knocked out, or were they all, what were they based on, your confidence?
My issues have never really been real world problems in the sense that it wasn't how I looked. It wasn't if I was smart. It wasn't if I was achieving well, whether I could pick up a girl. The things that have almost buried me have been invisible belief systems that have eroded my soul. Two in particular, one being I, for most of my life, believed to the core that I was crazy and therefore completely unworthy of belonging. And I don't mean like crazy as in, oh, that guy's a bit kooky. I was like, there is something wrong with my hardwiring. The second belief system I had for a very long time, most of my life, was I am a bad person. And that manifested in prepubescent years in acute OCD because I thought I was possessed. I was that bad. Like, I would have a thought that most normal, healthy kids would have. And in my mind, for somewhere, like, let's say, for example, when I started having thoughts about girls coming into puberty, I was like, oh, you're the worst. You're possessed by the devil. Like, something is wrong. And that produced this intensive, intrusive thought loop, which thank OCD for, which just buries your self-image. So the thoughts of I'm a bad person, I'm a crazy person, pretty much drove me to the point of wanting to take my own life on multiple occasions. And they now no longer have power over me because I don't believe either of them. But the thing I'm proudest of most, even though I've started the mental health charity and speak on stage and worked at Microsoft and all that other stuff, that's not what I'm most proud of. What I'm most proud of is I remember vividly staring down a mental metaphorical hole of insanity. I remember exactly where I was. I was standing on a wharf on the side of a lake in Seattle. I had just left a doctor's appointment and I could literally feel psychosis one single step away from me. And I remember being like, if I go there, I'm never coming out. Ever.
Wow.
And it was like alluring me. I was like, I'm going to have a psychotic break right now. I can fucking feel it. I was just holding on to reality. And I fought so, so hard to claw my way back into a rational mindset and to now be living and working in mental health for my whole life. But I remember the exact moment in time where I was like, I could go off that deep end right now into this black hole and never return. And I'm most proud of fighting myself out of that than any real world accomplishment.
That's really interesting, man. I find that a lot of people struggle in their life because we have, when you have internal struggles, some people really turn to try and find, they rely on external solutions for external internal problems. So what I mean by that is if I've got trauma, buying a new suit, it'd just be silly for me to say, and it's not true. Like, I'll buy this new suit, it takes my trauma away. An external material doesn't fix an internal struggle like that. And it's interesting, like, you can throw yourself into accomplishments, you can throw yourself in those, and in part they can top up some type of level of satisfaction, but fizzles quick. So how did you, I mean, that's a whole interview in itself for you, but like, just tell me one thing, because I'm really interested about how you got through breaking that belief. What did you have to do to break the belief and not listen to it?
Let it be true for a moment, as opposed to run away from it. And it was the experiencing of, okay, maybe that is that actually it completely lost its grip and ran away. And in all the ironies, considering we've spoken about bullying, I feel like a lot of those internal belief systems are bullies. And the best way to confront a bully, in my experience, is to not give them power, not give them fear, not run away, not buy into that bullshit. And I think for the first time ever, I was like, what do you want from me? All right, I am all those things. Fine,
Love
you
it.
fucking got me. I'm not scared of you. You know, if that is who I am, if I am crazy, if I'm a bad person, then so be it. And it was the final acceptance and almost the duality of surrendering, but completely not buying into the bullshit, both at the same time, that the bully just started to go, aha, you've woken up. Now we don't have any power over you. And slowly that evaporated. And also, like, other than that, you know, seeing people in my life that when I was about to lose everything, still love me, I was like, oh, it doesn't, none of this actually matters because I always have and always will belong. So I can fall off the deep end if I want to. And after giving myself permission to let all that fear in and whatever may be, it actually went away.
Perfect scene, a perfect analogy for what you said then about taking on the internal bully or those things in your mind that are trying to kill you, so you can kill your life, is the scene from 8 Mile with Eminem. It's the Eminem scene where at the end he's fighting the champion rap artist where they're just shredding each other, and he beats him to the punch with every
Correct.
single thing he could say. And Mike drops it and couldn't fight him. It defeated him because I killed you in advance. I know what you're gonna say. That's part of what we do in social kung fu. One of our modules, man, is in terms of resilience building is we have several tables where you have to fill out the best description you can about your life. So one table is the obvious is your physical attributes. How tall are you? How would you describe your nose? How would you describe your weight? How would you describe your height? On a level of attractiveness out of 10, how would you see yourself? And it stumps young people, but when they fill it out and then they go back over it as, okay, imagine you're a bully. What could they say easily about these types of attributes? Like, what names could they call you? What have they called you already? And then on the third round, it's like, okay, don't leave them hanging because you'd feel bad. It's like, oh yeah, I'm short, blah 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 blah. This is like, what would a fair judge say? So one of the premises of social kung fu is we're all judges. Everyone in young people always say this in our service, like, I fear judgment. It's like, well, if there's judgment, then that means there's judges. Who are those judges? You're one of them. Your neighbor's one of them. The question isn't if we have judgment or not. The question is it fair? What's it based on? Every judge needs to base their decision through a law of fairness or of justice. So go back over your answers. What did you say about yourself? That's internal referencing. That's like getting your view of yourself in. What does externally, how could that be seen? And then lastly, if you were a fair judge, would you say those things are accurate? And that's one of the exercises in our curriculum, which is being researched by the Sydney University at the moment. So by this time next year, it'll be evidence-based. So I'm very, very excited about that. From someone who got I'm very proud of that because with my journey in academia, it's like the most unlikely thing, but I want science is all about figuring out what works, and I'm keen to see how it goes.
Yeah, man, I think you're a kung fu master at rewriting stories. And, you know, as someone who has rewritten a story of I'm not academic and I'm prone to bullying, to I now lead a movement of overcoming bullying and have a formula that is so robust that universities want to study it. That is what I take away from Matt. You know, Matt is a sensei of changing narratives and not succumbing to what the external world says you can be. And that is a testament to your character, man. And so for people to want to follow on your journey, where's the best place for them to find you?
I think Instagram's where I'm most active. I'm Matt Purcell. Just look up Matt Purcell. You'll see some Asian dude smiling. And Social Kung Fu is my education movement, I guess, or company that's mission is to train 1 million students in Australia with verbal self-defense. And yeah, it's really exciting. I mean, like, we got Professor Carolyn Hunt from University of Sydney. She is like the president of the Psychology Association of Australia. She's like the queen, literally the person for anxiety in Australia. And she's taking on this project. And I just could not believe the willingness to want to do it. She's got a huge passion to help young people. And there's an interview of me and her on YouTube now. We just put it up, just discussing, like, the process of research has been frustrating. It's so long through it to get things through ethics and everything like that. Because I'm a business dude at heart too. So it's like, I'm like, Carolyn, Professor Carolyn, who do I need to send a nice box of flowers to get this signed off? Like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
She's laughing, going, welcome to academia.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good fully. Times.
So, brother, what is one piece of advice that you think that you've been told or you live by that you'd like our listeners to know?
There's a couple, but I'll choose one. Thinkers need to do and doers need to think. What I mean by that is, from my nature, is like, I'm a doer. And some people think, oh, doers are the best. Doers are what you want to do. It's like, well, if you're doing seven things wrong at once, it's not a good thing to be a doer. And that way, you got to learn to think a bit. And thinkers tend to procrastinate and to theoretically go through things and have a good plan. But they can. Their big enemy is not acting out what they know. They're not obeying the knowledge that they might have learnt, so they don't have a lot to show for it. So thinkers need to do, but doers definitely need to think, because I've been a doer my whole life up to, and then I realized you can dive into water thinking it's deep, but it's shallow and you can snap your neck. And the more I've got into the world of business the last 10 years, and you would know this, Mitch, like, strategy, it's a thinking thing and it's a doing thing, but before you do, you need a strategy, and the planning is a thinking thing. And I've become much more of a thinker in my later years than actually a doer. And it's funny how I start at this end, but I've gravitated toward the opposite end. So I'd say, if I put on a billboard, thinkers do and doers think.
Love it. Well, brother, thank you so much for thinking with me out loud today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the pod, and looking forward to continuing to connect, and hopefully many other people to connect with you too.
Yeah, thanks, man. And I just want to say before we finish, Mitch, you're part of a new breed, a new gen of thought leadership. I think we have people who live right now that are, you know, from a generation that spoke to a generation that are now going into, and they're carrying on their life and they're aging. I like the new gen. I like some of the entrepreneurs I'm seeing in the world. I love seeing the Mitches of the world, because a lot of them have a lot more soul and a lot more human grounding than just being all about achievement. I feel like previous generations, we might have overdosed on, you are what you do, you are what you do, you are what you do. It's like, do, have, be. You have to do to have, then you are somebody. I feel like you're a guy that's like, no, let's figure out, who do you need to be to do, then to have. And I think you're just about to blow up, man. I'm here. I'm cheering you on.
Thank you, brother. That means a lot, especially coming from someone who, has a fairly wide view of the world and voices in this space. It means a lot. It's very humbling. Thank you.
No worries, man. Thanks for having me.